You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Kathleen Smith. Dr. Smith is an associate faculty member at the Bowen Center for the Study of the Family. She hosts the show Family Matters, which is a product of the University of the District of Columbia, and she has written for publications such as Slate, Salon, New York Magazine, Life Hacker, Bustle, and Counseling Today. She has a new book. It's called Everything Isn't Terrible, Conquer Your Insecurities, Interrupt Your Anxiety, and Finally Calm Down. Dr. Kathleen Smith, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
In the introduction to your book, you write, quote, in a recent public opinion poll, the American Psychiatric Association reported that a majority of Americans are anxious about their safety, their health, their finances, their relationships, and of course, politics, end quote. So we're basically anxious about everything, it seems.
Pretty much. We have lots of reasons to be. And starting the new year, we have even more.
Yeah. I guess like today and yesterday and the day before, right?
Absolutely.
So you say also in the introduction, quote, we're reacting instead of acting, leading, and calming the hell down. And one of the things I love about this book is that you are not afraid to speak like a human being. So you tell jokes, you use words that you normally wouldn't use in this. But talk to us about, like, what is going on now that is so dangerous?
Dangerous. I think what's happening is that we're leading with our anxiety. We're letting that lizard brain, that lizard part of the back of our brain that wants to protect us, to kind of direct all of our actions and how we respond to each other, how we respond to the news. And, while that self-preservation instinct can be very useful sometimes, it can get in the way of our best thinking and who we're trying to be on a day-to-day basis. And when everyone around you, in person and on the internet is reacting the same way, it's very contagious, and it's difficult to think in as an individual in the middle of all that.
And before we jump into the various chapters, you introduce us to a theory of human behavior called Bowen theory. So I want you to talk to us about what that is, because it really guides a lot of the content in the book.
Yeah, so Bowen theory was sort of the first family therapy theory that emerged sort of in the middle of the 20th century. This guy, Murray Bowen, he was a psychiatrist, and he worked with people who had schizophrenia. And he noticed that when he worked with the entire family and observed how the entire family interacted with each other, the person with schizophrenia had a much better chance of their symptoms improving and them doing better if he engaged the entire family. So it's sort of this idea that if you just look at an individual and their own anxiety, you miss out on the bigger picture, because so much of how our anxiety manifests itself is behavioral in relationship to other people. So what I love about Bowen theory is that it zooms out. It looks at the whole family, the whole workplace, the whole society or organization to give you a better picture of how your anxiety is affecting you as an individual, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and this is something that runs through. These are the aha moments I had in this book continually, because, we've interviewed other scholars, and this idea comes up in different ways, but mostly it's that we
tend to, as human beings, look inward and think it's one thing at play, and it's at least a dyad, if not, you know, more things. And the idea of that we're always in relationship, and one should understand what how that is influencing your particular behavior in a moment, doesn't feel like a natural act to us as human beings.
Yeah, and I think we love to think that we're unique, but we're social creatures. We're not that different from other animals, you know, and it's, you know, a lot of the things we do in groups and families and organizations are no different than what you see in the animal kingdom when things get anxious.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I'm really eager to talk to you about your first chapter because one of the elemental aspects of improvisation is teaching people to exercise their point of focus. And we promote this idea that one needs to be more others focused with the idea that we often don't listen well to others or take into account other people's perspectives. But you contend that one of our major problems is that we're actually not focusing on ourselves enough or even accurately.
Well, I think what happens is that we become other focused because we start to interpret everyone else's behavior as a potential threat to us. So if someone is, we don't want to annoy people, we don't want people to be angry with us, we don't want people to hurt us or jeopardize the things we're working for. And so our way of preventing that is to carefully study, you know, somebody we're dating or our boss or, you know, whomever, and then to control that person so that doesn't happen to us. And, you know, but ultimately you can't control anyone else. And so we waste a lot of energy trying to mind read and to motivate, you know, other people to do the things we want them to do.
It's interesting. I've used a line that I got from a Near IL book, which is, it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. And I think that's one of those cases, right? Because it's very good. You want to be empathetic and you want to focus on someone else's needs. But that can also turn into a bad thing when you're letting it affect you in unhealthy ways.
Yeah. And I think the difference is when you're super other focused, you lose in touch with reality. There's a difference between observing what a person is saying and doing and imagining what they're going to do or, you know, guessing, right? So there's nothing wrong with focusing on other people, but sometimes when our imagination kind of takes hold and runs with that idea that we get ourselves into trouble.
With apologies to Simon Sinek, you also have some issues with the why, that can be problematic.
Yeah, absolutely. Because why is a cause and effect question? Why usually, you know, means whose fault is it? I'm anxious. Who has caused my anxiety? You know, when there are usually lots of factors, and it's much more complex in human relationships than just one person being the villain a lot of the time.
So this is a rule in improvisation, especially with early improvisers, is you try to get them to not ask a lot of questions because that puts the onus on you're not really building something together if you're just asking the whys. It's a bad way to create scripts together. And I think there's something at play with that, with what you're talking about. You also talk about Bowen's theory of differentiation, which I think is an important thing for people to understand early.
So differentiation is sort of the goal. You know, the more differentiated you are, the more able you are to deal with stressful situations. So there's kind of two parts of it. There's the part, you know, can you tease apart your emotions from your thinking? And can you figure out what your thinking is, in, you know, that's separate from other people's? So a lot of times if someone else is anxious or they have an opinion, it's contagious. We just absorb it or borrow it without, you know, accessing our own thinking. So the idea is that if you can be more differentiated, it's easier for you to know your own mind when things get really, really stressful and to calm yourself down versus just, you know, the anxiety being contagious when things get stressful.
And you have a good metaphor for this where you talk about thinking of your anxiety like a smoke alarm.
Yeah. So how I think about it is that some people have more sensitive alarms than others. I'm not a great cook, so my smoke alarm goes off all the time.
All right.
And, you know, I don't beat it to death with a broom. I don't run screaming out of the house because I'm aware that there is no fire. But sometimes with our anxiety, we act as if there's a fire without looking around and asking, okay, what's the reality here? Is this a really threatening situation or is this something that's completely manageable that I don't need to freak out about?
Another thing you say in this chapter is, quote, "I truly believe that the opposite of anxiety is curiosity." I love that. Tell us more about why you say that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the one unique thing about being human is that we have this part of our brain that can solve problems like no other creature. And if you are able to be curious about your anxiety and how you're functioning, especially in relationships, you're using a different part of your brain than the one that just reacts, that freezes up or fights or, you know, flees. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more people sort of treat themselves as a research project and can really just laugh at themselves and be interested at how, you know, they regularly screw up when they go home for Thanksgiving or something, mm-hmm. you know, it really allows them to have some flexibility and think about how they want to act differently. But if you're just beating yourself up and, you know, are so ashamed or frustrated with it, it's really hard to do anything differently than what you would normally do.
So we note this when we're teaching people improvisation is that, you know, we tend to go to the same familiar patterns over and over again, whether they're, you know, apt or correct. And so we have exercises like where we'll force people to walk around a room, point at an object and name that object with a word that it isn't. And it's very hard for people to do that. So if there's a rock there and they say, you know, paper, it takes a moment. But what we're finding is that it's sort of freeing the mind a bit to play with what's possible and what's new, you know, basically practicing divergent thinking.
I love that. That's so interesting. You know, and I think that's so true. Our autopilot is just so locked in, and it's there for a reason. You know?
Yeah.
We do what we do to calm things down, and we've been doing it for millennia, and it works pretty well until it doesn't.
Yeah. Know? Yeah.
And so being able to do something different or practicing doing something different is just so important, but it's really hard.
Yeah. You also talk about how we have two selves. You call it a solid self and a pseudo self. So what are those two selves?
Yeah. So there's this idea that you really can't judge how calm or how mature a person is based on just being around them. Mm-hmm. We're pretty good at pretending to have it, you know, more together than we actually do. Mm-hmm. And so there's this idea that your pseudo self is the part of you that is negotiable. So if different people are in the room, I might act differently to please them or to calm them down. Or I might perform better at work if I have a boss who's going to praise me all the time. Or, you know, a student might do better in school if they've had wonderful teachers who are always boosting their confidence, right? But your solid self is sort of how you actually function regardless of who's in the room, regardless of whether you're getting attention or approval or praise. You know, and so the idea is that the more you can kind of evaluate yourself and define your own beliefs and what's important to you, your anxiety or your mood won't kind of go up and down as steeply based on how people are responding to you. You know, so the more kind of solid self you can have, the better you're going to do, you know, on a bad day or when somebody just really annoys you or makes you upset.
People talk all the time how, you know, government should run more like business. And it's like, it's such an American thing to say. And it's not true because they're fundamentally different. And you talk about in this book that there's an idea in this country that humans should operate like business. And it's like, that was like, that is so absolutely true that people think that. And yet it makes no sense.
Yeah. And I think that's because people don't take the time to define what a good life or what good work looks like. That's that pseudo self that's just borrowing definitions from the culture and from the world around us. So if the culture says, you know, steep success and growth every year, you know, is the measure, then we just borrow that and say, oh, well, that must be true.
This is one of those rare books that gets even better at the end. You know, so many people don't. I always read all the book. I feel like I have to with the conversations. But, you know, so many people stop reading and really like the last few chapters are amazing. And I was really interested in this idea around procrastination and productivity as a relationship problem. And I've brought this up to a few people around the office, and everyone was like really intrigued by this idea. So talk to us how that could possibly be a relationship problem.
Yeah, so usually when people procrastinate, they think of it as a character or personality flaw. You know, if they could only read the right time management book or motivate themselves to wake up at 5 a.m., then they'd be, you know, a mass-producing machine. Mm-hmm. You know, but again, we're social creatures. And so when you sit down to complete a task or do a project or think about a project, there are all these people, you know, there's this big audience in your brain that are either expecting the work or they're going to react to the work. They might like it, they might not. You know, and so often our desire to win that approval or attention from others can really set you back and keep you from staying focused on what you actually think or what the work could look like. And so often just realizing that anytime you produce something, there is a relationship, unless you like are a monk or live in the middle of nowhere. Or in the book, I say, if you're, you know, a doomsday prepper living off the grid, you know, if you're working, you know, everything you do has a relationship component. So it can be really useful to think about, okay, what are the relationships here and how are they distracting me from what I think and what needs to get done?
I was thinking, we had this colleague, he's no longer with the company, but I mean, he could not hit send on a proposal. I mean, they would just sit in his, you know, on his email or, you know, as a draft. And literally people would have to go over and go, I'm hitting send, like on his computer. And I can only, I was like, what fear do you have of the person receiving this? You know, that it's like, are you just putting it off because in the chance that you won't win the business, which I think it kind of was.
Sure. But I mean, that's, you know, part of the bargain of doing any work, or especially, you know, being an artist or a writer, is that other people get to respond to your work. That's part of the deal. And that can really get in people's heads and cause a lot of problems.
And you write in the book too, quote, just because you're not talking to someone doesn't mean you're not in relationship with them. That's valuable to know. I mean, you could not have talked to someone for 10 years. It doesn't mean that you don't have a relationship for good or bad.
Yeah, it could be a dead relative. It could be, you know, I'm constantly trying to impress people I went to high school with that I haven't talked to.
Oh, we're all doing that.
You know, in 20 years.
It's called Facebook,
right?
And Instagram. Yep. This is another thing that's in one of the later chapters. Quote, a 2017 report found that television shows had influenced 39% of British millennials when making their career choice. Wow.
Yeah, isn't that funny? I mean, especially in D.C., you know, I live in D.C. and how many West Wing people, you know, ended up, West Wing fans ended up here because of their, you know, infatuation with the show. I think that's just more evidence of how, you know, anxiety or not being in touch with reality can keep you from making really fact-based decisions about your life.
You make this joke in the book, but it is true, because all my friends in D.C. say that it is not like the West Wing. It's like Veep.
Exactly.
Which is really funny yet depressing.
It's past the point of Veep now, even, you know, Veep is
oh, yeah. No. Yeah, it's I don't even know what it is. Also, very interesting chapter on smartphones and social media. You say, quote, we all love to blame our phones for ushering in this increasingly anxious era, end quote. But you don't really blame the phones.
Yeah, I mean, I had a book event last night and somebody asked this question. They said, you know, is technology to blame? And I said, you know, I think technology just allows us to do what we've done for forever, just faster and more efficiently. You know, if I'm anxious, what I want to do is complain to a friend, you know, vent about it, and that'll calm me down. And, you know, back in the day, I had to go out and find somebody who would listen to me. But now I can just whip out my phone and text a friend or tweet, you know, and say, you won't believe what just happened, and all these people are comforting me or taking my side, right? So The things that we do are avoiding people, right? Technology makes it really easy to not have person-to-person contact. So it just allows us to do what we've already been doing for a really long time, and it makes it that much harder to think for yourself and turn off that autopilot.
And you ask a provocative question. I think it's provocative. It's, quote, we live in a society that values immediacy and drama, so the most reactive voices are often the ones getting the most elevated. But entertain this question for me. If someone asked you to show them your most mature online self, what would you show them? Can you answer that question for yourself?
Yeah, I think I can. can. You know, I write a weekly newsletter. It's called The Anxious Overachiever, and it's sort of my place to sit down and gather my thoughts every week about how I'm working on myself, how I'm working with clients. And it's easy because it's email, right? So I don't have that immediate reaction of people liking it or retweeting it or whatever. But mm-hmm. I think so much of how we perform and what we do online is getting that immediate reaction and that approval and that attention, or joining in other people's outrage, right? And yeah. So just because it's online or it's social media doesn't mean that there's not space for mature, fact-based thinking. But, you know, the culture may not be as big of a fan of that.
It really isn't. It really isn't. But I do, I mean, the fatigue on the other end, right? I think most of the people we talk to on the podcast are so tired of the lack of nuance, the raised voices and the screaming, and just looking for people to sort of, what you know, how can we be more wise and loving and gracious and hopeful? Because those are really the important qualities, not all the stuff we're banging drums about.
Sure. I think what happens is that when people get frustrated, they want to try and teach everyone else on the internet how to behave. And I think just remembering that, you know, the best way to make a tiny difference or to help calm things down is to just manage yourself, manage your own reactivity, how you respond to things, how you choose to engage with people. And that makes a bigger difference than you think. I think people notice that much more than you trying to teach them how to be less reactive on Twitter, or, you know, more careful when they're sharing an article that might not be true. We love to tell everyone else what to do. It's much harder to just live that on your own.
Right, because you have, you know, you've got to define yourself, and this, you talk about this in the book, and that is not a short-term project, and it's not an easy project.
No, it's not. And, you know, we want it to make a difference right away. And sometimes it does. I think the people around you might start to notice. But I think, you know, and I talk about this book, it's all about the long game of making a difference in the long term through sort of your best thinking and your most mature self.
And families play kind of a big role in this definition of yourselves. You write, quote, "Families are notoriously uncreative in how they manage stress." Play that out for us a little bit.
Yeah. So in the book, I talk about a couple of ways that, and this could be for any group, not just a family, but mm-hmm. a couple of ways that you can observe how your family manages stress. And it's really useful to remember that these aren't good or bad. It's just sort of what families do. You know, some families, they use distance. They avoid each other. They don't talk about things other than the weather or sports. You know, other families, they fight a lot and blame a particular person for being the problem, and that calms everybody else down. You know, other families, one person overfunctions and takes on all the responsibility, and other people just kind of sit back and let them do it. You know, and the more you can kind of start to observe how your family functions, the less you'll see particular people as the problem or the villain, and the more you can kind of just observe it and say, yeah, this makes sense that we do this, but do I want to participate in that? Or do I want to do something different to calm myself down and to maybe be the most mature person, you know, at Thanksgiving or at this funeral, you know?
Right. The work that we do in the behavioral science community, a lot of it revolves around the research about how human beings just really want to be seen as they see themselves. And yet we're constantly sort of deflecting, and I think you write in the book about dodging being truly be seen by others, when really that all the research says that that's what we need and what we want.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's useful because being able to share what you actually think and who you actually are can be really challenging, especially in a family. Because people will not always be crazy about it. Mm-hmm. But the ability to do that regardless of the response is such a useful skill. And I think what I tell people is that it's like, you know, when Olympic athletes train at a higher elevation mm-hmm. To sort of increase their their capacity to perform. If families is the same way. If you can work on doing that in your family, I mean, you are set at work, with your friendships, romantic relationships, especially your parents. If you have parents who are alive, you know, being able to be an individual, be a self in relationship with them is just the best way to do the work, because it's the hardest place to do it.
Yeah. I mean, so many people, when we're out giving our workshops on improv, are like, oh, I'm going to use this in my parenting. I'm always like, 100%. It's just about how humans behave, and a great place to test it out is in the home.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Before I ask for your yes and story, which I will in a minute, I want to talk about the chapter around finding community, because this is hugely important. And I think it's related to some of the problems that we've got going on in the world right now, especially the sort of people who are isolated and not living within communities. And so they are taking out, you know, really their sadness or their rage as trolls and sort of in the online world. And you say in this chapter, quote, anxiety is a condition best fueled by isolation and rumination. This is a dangerous place as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, you know, a lot of my clients are, they're millennials, they're in their 20s, 30s, and it's so common for people to not be a part of any community group or organization or religious group. It's just that demographic, you know, we're just not a part of as many communities as we used to be. And when that's not available to people, you know, they'll seek out ones that might be very welcoming, but very dangerous at the same time. But I think it's just important to remember that communities are humans, right? So they have their own history, they have their own, you know, amount of anxiety. And just sort of going into it, being aware of that can be really useful for a person, and they won't be quite as reactive maybe when somebody rubs them the wrong way.
All right. We end every podcast by asking our guests to tell us a yes and story, a time in their life when they normally maybe would have said no, but instead they didn't just say yes, they said yes and. Do you have a story for us?
Yeah, just a short one. So when I first started getting published, when I was in grad school and writing about therapy, and I was writing about pop culture stuff as well, you know, I had a really hard time getting rejected. You know, in my history in school, I was used to being accepted to things and hearing yeses from people. And I really wanted to work on my ability to hear no from people and to be rejected and to see that it was completely manageable. And so I set this goal to, you know, get rejected as much as possible. And that seems to be going really well. It still hurt. It was still difficult. But I decided to take an up a notch, and I guess this is my yes and. I said, you know, not only am I going to get rejected, I'm going to get rejected from increasingly impressive places. You know, this week it's, you know, like, you know, New York Times Magazine, or next week it's the Washington Post. Like, I'm going to hear a no from these people, and that's going to be how I measure that I'm doing the work. Not the approvals or the yeses I get. It's going to be the fact that I took it to the next step and made an even riskier, you know, move in submitting something. And that's the funny story, is that's actually how I found an agent, because I one day I said, well, what's the next level? And I said, oh, well, I guess I'll send this thing that I wrote to, you know, a literary agency, and that'll be impressive to get rejected from. And, you know, lo and behold, someone actually looked at it and went, oh, well, this is interesting. So I feel incredibly fortunate, you know, that we found each other. But at the same time, it's because I was willing to, you know, to just get rejected from more impressive places. And so to me, that was a creative way of working on that sensitivity that I had to being rejected, to see that it wasn't necessarily about getting the yes, but it was opening up to the possibility that a yes could happen.
I love that. I was just having this conversation with my 22-year-old last night at dinner. So he's home for the break, and he goes back for his final semester. He'll graduate this year from college, and he wants to be an actor in Chicago. So he set up a bunch of informational interviews, and one of our friends who's an artistic director at a theater set him up on a call with a casting agent, and he's like, I don't know what to say. And my wife was just like, just call. you know, and you know, you're going to see what happens. He got an audition. He's auditioning for a TV show today. So it was like,
there you go.
And it was the moment where he's like, I can't believe this happened. I'm like, amazing things happen when you sort of say yes and to the world, where you allow yourself to take that chance and know that as an actor, you are going to get rejected probably 90% of the time, at least. And the arts can teach us those things, right? Because the artists accept it. They're like, yeah, no, that, but you keep going back. And a lot of times that muscle is for business people is one they haven't flexed, so that they get so frustrated when they get the no, and I think it makes them not speak up. I think it makes them not hit send, and I think it's really just it's a sad place to be.
Yeah, I mean, you have to teach your anxiety that the stakes are not that high.
Yes,
there is no fire, and that rejection is completely manageable and very useful.
The book is called Everything Isn't Terrible: Conquer Your Insecurities, Interrupt Your Anxiety, and Finally Calm Down. Dr. Kathleen Smith, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot.
Getting the S&N is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive from adulthood. No one survives.